Today's Teisho will be on case 12 in the Book of Serenity. Case 12 is entitled Dijong Planting the Fields. Introduction: scholars plow with the pen, orators plow with the tongue. We patch-robed mendicants lazily watch a white ox on open ground, not paying attention to the rootless, auspicious grass. How to pass the days? Dijong asked Zhuishan, "Where do you come from?" Zhuishan said, "From the south." Dijong said, "How is Buddhism in the south these days?" Zhuishan said, "There's extensive discussion." Dijong said, How can that compare to me here planting the fields and making rice to eat?" Zhuishan said, "What can you do about the world?" Dijong said, "What do you call the world?" Verse, source and explanation variously are all made up. Passing to ear from mouth, it comes apart. Planting fields, making rice, ordinary household matters. Only those who have investigated to the full would know. Having investigated to the full, you clearly know there's nothing to seek. Zhifeng, after all, didn't care to be enfeoffed as a marquis. Forgetting his state, he returned, same as fish and birds, washing his feet in the Kong Long, the hazy waters of autumn. So I want to thank you all for coming here to practice and to the Sesshin. This is so important. Sesshin is the heart of Zen practice. You know, there's nothing, if you don't practice regularly, you know, and you just come to Sesshin, this would be like a nightmare experience, right? And probably not very beneficial, not much. You'd get through it, but it wouldn't really be that beneficial. So it's really crucial to practice regularly. If you can make time to sit every day, or at least, you know, maybe five times a week, and you can sit for a extended period of time, like you know, an hour, you know, something like that. That would be wonderful. If you can sit with our group and you can do an hour and a half, all the better, right? So daily practice, regular practice is essential. But then there's nothing like Sesshin, right? I mean, there's nothing like this sustained concentration. And so I'm so glad you understand that. I'm so glad you're here. You know, we're going through a process. Last night I mentioned, you know, trust the process. We're going through a process. You know, there's a pretty predictable trajectory. You know, day one is, you know, basically right now we're sort of detaching a little bit. You know, so you may have affairs at home or concerns that brought you to Sesshin, right? You know, you may be sitting on the cushion thinking about this or that, and, you know, you may have some nagging doubts about whether you've made a mistake coming here, right? You may think, oh dear, you know, I have so much to do. Why did I do this? You know, And that's sort of normal first day thinking. You know, it's as though, you know, you're trying to get some distance on your everyday life. And it's hard because, you know, all of those are like, those are all mental habits. You know, what we call everyday reality is really made up of a bunch of mental habits. And it's hard to detach yourself from those or free yourself from those. You know, the next day will be different. the day after that will be really different, and the final days will be wonderful, I predict.
Yeah.
But day one is a complicated affair, because you know we have one foot in the world back home, and one foot here. You know, and you may in a way that's really good, right? I mean, something at home brought you here, right? Something that you were unable to resolve in your everyday life brought you to Zen. And if it weren't for those frustrations and those difficulties, you wouldn't be here at all. You know, so it's wonderful that you responded to your difficulties by coming here. But you know, the thing is about our mental habits that we can't really get out of our traps just by repeating the same behaviors. You know, even you know, I myself have benefited from therapy, and I have the highest respect for therapy, right? Nevertheless, I know people who have gone to therapy for like 20 years. And I also know therapists, right, who say, you know, they have patients who have gone to therapy for 20 years and even going to therapy can become a kind of habit. It can almost become a kind of like habit of postponement. So please don't think that I'm criticizing therapy, because I definitely am not. But you know, therapy too can become routine. You know, so it's like Wednesday, time to go to the therapist, and you can unload on the therapist. You can, and the therapist can, you know, basically help you a little bit, and then you go home. You know, the next week, Wednesday, you know, and as long as the money holds out, you know, you can keep going to your therapist. And it's also a habit, right? Also habit. So again, not criticizing. And people I know who have gone to therapy have benefited enormously. But everything can become a habit. Even sitting can become a habit, right? Absolutely. So, you know, if you just sit down on the cushion, you know, every other day, and you get a buzz on, you know, you get a samadhi buzz on, that's great. You know, it feels great. After a stressful day, you know, you come in, you sit down on the cushion, and about, you know, 15 minutes in, you have a relaxation response. About 35 minutes in, you start entering samadhi. It's so purifying, right? And, you know, you can have had the worst day, and you could come in and sit down on the cushion, and after 40 minutes, you're laughing, right? And that happens sometimes, or at least you feel better. You get off the cushion, you feel, oh, that feels better. But, you know, even that can become a habit. Even that can become just another habit, just another routine. You know, if you read the literature of Zen, if you read Zen like the Linji Lu, the book of Rinzai, you know, he often has these explosions where he'll say to the monks, you guys just sit on your ass all day and eat, you get your meals, your two meals a day. You shove your rice and your black beans in your faces, and then you go back down and sit. And he seems to be drenched with contempt. And that's sort of his style, is very dramatic. But what he's saying is, you know, you've made a routine out of your practice. You know, you're just putting in your time on the cushion, right? You're waiting, putting in your time on the cushion and waiting for lunch, right? So you know, it's definitely possible to, you know, just build around yourself this fabric of routines And that it has a kind of like anesthetizing effect, right? And actually, most people live this way, right? You know, most people, you know, they have these sources of injury, or these sources of discontent, or these sources of they feel, you know, broken, or they feel unsustained, or they, you know, all these different issues. But, you know, we build like a little fabric. We wrap ourselves in a fabric of routines, and it gets us through. People say it gets me through the day, right? You know, so you know, if you can work really hard, you know, and then you can come home. And my father-in-law was an interesting, I loved my father-in-law a lot. You know, he was really somebody who meant a lot to me in my life. And he had actually worked at Los Alamos. Everybody's going to see the Oppenheimer movie, and you won't see a guy playing my father-in-law. He was a very minor person on that base. And afterwards, he worked for Sandia Labs in Albuquerque. And you know, his life was very highly routinized, right? And I loved him. He was a very charismatic guy, very nice man, very creative, you know. But you know, he'd get up early, he'd go to work, he'd, you know, come home, and you know, basically he liked to do things like he built guitars, you know. So he would build some guitars, and he would build a clavichord once. He was like a design engineer, so he would do. He had a wood shop, you know. He could take a car apart and put it back together. He was really interested in how things work. And some of his guitars were really good. People who play guitar actually bought them from him. And so, you know, he was very creative. But I noticed his life was very highly routinized, right? He'd come home, and you know, on the weekends he'd work in his shop, but in the evening he'd just watch TV like for hours and hours, and go to bed and get up and do it again. And you know, he was a human being. He was somebody I dearly loved, but like all of us, you know, he had a lot of issues that we didn't resolve. You know, he and my mother-in-law had a lot of tensions they couldn't work out. And my father-in-law, you know, was like had serial affairs, and that drove my mother-in-law crazy, right? And you know, they never resolved these issues, right? It was like, I sort of got into this family, I thought, oh my God, this is the most amazing family. And the idea of these were people I would be living my life with was very exciting. My father-in-law is very creative. He's this design engineer who, you know, makes his own clavichords. He built the house, you know, designed the house. You know, my mother-in-law plays the piano. She can play a, you know, beautiful piano. But then, you know, as I got into this family, like every family, you know, there's all of this unresolved stuff, right? So my father-in-law and my mother-in-law were like constantly grating on each other. And, you know, my father-in-law had affairs with all kinds of people, and my mother-in-law felt betrayed and angry. She had, you know, four children with this guy. And you know, years later, many years, like, you know, 40 years later, my wife found some letters that my father-in-law had written to my mother-in-law after the war, you know, when he was he wrote these wonderful love letters to her. You know, they're so beautiful, and you think, how did these people go so wrong? You know, how did they go so wrong? Because they started out with all this love, and they wound up in this place that was kind of awful, you know. And you know what they did was they all built like these routines, this fabric of routines, right? And so they never solved their problems. It's like building a little enclosure around yourself of bricks, right? And you have all these bricks, and you close yourself in. You're now secure, right? And they all did this. It was like nobody talked about anything, right? As I realized later, nobody talks about any of this. It's like unspoken, right? It's like it's all this tension and all this friction and all this injury, and it's all unspoken. And I think this is a typical situation, you know. So at least I think it is, you know. Hopefully all relationships are not like this, but you know, human beings, you know, they're so complicated. When people get to a point where they can't stand it anymore, they do go to a therapist. And I think the value of a therapist is it's this exterior perspective, right? It's like the therapist goes and gives the patient an exterior perspective, and it's so helpful, so helpful. And you know, if you're a patient of a therapist and you really take advantage of that, you know, you have to have the courage to get a perspective you might not welcome on yourself, right? And you know, you can play the game with your therapist where you're carefully avoiding that experience where the therapist gives you some news that, you know, about yourself that you might not welcome. And you can avoid that and go, you know, on and on in therapy and not, you know, take advantage of your therapist. But if you take advantage of your therapist, you're looking for that outsider perspective. And it's that's what's liberating, I think. That's what's liberating, right? Is, you know, you have it all figured out. You have your world all figured out, and then you go and somebody shows you something that you completely concealed from yourself. And it's like, oh my God. You know, if you're willing to entertain that person's, you know, somebody will say, you know, look at how aggressive you are. It's like, I'm aggressive? Me? You know, I'm the nicest guy in the world. And then suddenly you realize, oh my gosh, you know, I'm sort of carrying around this chip on my shoulder all day. Now change is possible, right? Now change is possible. It's like when you look at your life yourself, you can't see what you've done. You know, my wife's family, they just couldn't see it. But as an outsider, it was like, oh my, at first I thought, this is the most wonderful family. And then the more I got into it, the more I realized, oh my God, this is like insane, right? But human. And they needed an exterior. I was just a young man. I wasn't in a position to tell my in-laws how to live their lives. But if only they could have gotten somebody who could have been an outside observer and said, look at the constant friction in your interactions. You know, that never happened. So, you know, going to a therapist is wonderful because you get that exterior perspective. That person can help you see what you've concealed from yourself as you were building this little wall around yourself. Well, I think Zen does something very similar. You know, I think Zen gives you an exterior perspective. And it's so liberating in that way. It's different from therapy. The goal of Zen is enlightenment, right? Something different from therapy. But that in some ways the method is very similar, right? You know, Zen is giving you an exterior perspective. And I'm not the therapist, you know. You're going to discover the therapist, you could say. You know, you have a therapist in yourself, right? And we Zen people call it your big mind. But you know, what happens is that you come to Sesshin, and you have all of these issues that are unresolved, and you gradually have to get some distance on your mental habits. And the distance you get on your mental habits, the system is designed to help you create that distance, right? So when you come to Sesshin, day one is like you're still in your familiar orbit. You're still in your orbit, right? But we're doing things a little differently. Most of you probably don't get up at 4:30 in the morning, generally. And so you probably don't do 8 hours of zazen a day. You probably don't eat the kind of food we eat here, or the way we eat our meals. All of this is sort of alienating a little bit. And you get tired, and it's very regimented, very structured. And, it's very common that people on day one or day two can feel lonely, right? I can tell you so many people who have said, on day two, I just keep thinking of home. I keep thinking of my home. And what they're saying in a way is, I want to be back in my routines. I want to be back in my routines. Because that's where I'm able to protect myself, right, with all my routines. So I have routines too. When I'm writing, if I'm in a frustrated place, sometimes I'll go down and I'll have a snack, right? So during the COVID period, it was easy to put on. I put on 10 pounds, because I would just say, "Well, time for a snack." So I was like snacking all day, right? It's easy to put on 10 pounds like in 3 months or something. It's rewarding yourself, so that's a routine. And I have other routines, right? So you could easily waste time on Facebook or doing something like that, So those are all protective routines. And when you come to Zen, to a Sesshin, you're still, craving those routines, right? And now everything's a little different. It's a little disorienting. And day one is where you feel like the tug. It's like you're the tug of all those tendrils, all of those routines, those habits. You're sort of craving to be back in them. And people will come into Dokusan and say, "Oh, I miss my home. Wish I were home. Wish I had my chair. It's in my chair, And if you're the kind of person who likes a drink in the evening, it's like, "Oh my God, it's 5 o'clock. I can't have a drink, So this is so important. If you're online, you've had to make the time. You've had to sort of make the time for this. Hopefully you've been able to carve out a space where you can practice and get a little bit of this alienation effect, right? It's like being alienated a little bit. And you even if you're practicing at home, you may feel that sort of like tug of those habits. It's like somebody who smokes cigarettes. After a certain amount of time, you start craving a cigarette, right? Because it's so familiar. All those things are satisfying, So day one is like that, right? And this koan is really a great koan, right? Dijong asked Shui Shan, "Where do you come from?" So this is like a monk who has just arrived. And Shui Shan says, "From the south." And Dijong said, "How is Buddhism in the south these days?" And Shui Shan says, "There's extensive discussion." And Dijong says, "How can you compare that to me here planting the fields and making rice to eat?" And Shui Shan says, "What can you do about the world?" And Dijong said, "What do you call the world?" So, once you come to Sesshin and you start experiencing like this some distance on the way you live, you begin to realize that the way you live is not real. See, I mean, people feel that the way they live is real. It feels totally real, right? I mean, unless you're having hallucinations or something, everything feels so real. Last night I was talking about that ethologist, animal behavior specialist, who was talking about all the ways animals experience the world that we don't experience, that we're so one-dimensional. You know, we're so visual. Everything is sight for us, everything. And we miss out on, we're inattentive to all these other features that our senses do allow us to be aware of, but habit makes them unimportant. And he says, and animals have this array of receptors, that we don't even have, like hearing ranges of sounds that we can't hear, right? And recently they've discovered all of these animals communicate, and we don't even know. They seem to be silent, right? Like I think the other day they were saying mice sing songs, right? Mice, we know they squeak, but they sing these songs. Unfortunately, they're at a wavelength we can't pick up. So you have some little mice in the cage, and they are all singing these beautiful songs, right? And we don't even know. And we're not going to develop new senses in doing zazen. But we are going to broaden our world. We're going to break out of our habits, right? Our energy habits, our habit energies. And we're going to be able to experience the world more richly. And part of that is actually like a derealization process, right? So, our lives seem so real and so important. And, as long as we're in that place, it's very hard to change, right? As long as there's that kind of desperation, that kind of, or play complacency, right? And you have to get out of your life, and as this happens, it's difficult because, we actually hold on to even our suffering, right? We even hold on to our suffering. Because our suffering is part of this this wall we've built around ourselves, right? And on day one, you're starting to let go of all that. And if everything goes according to plan, around day two, a lot of things that were very urgent will begin to seem remote, remote. In Buddhist tradition, some women and men choose to become home leavers. And these are people who are like ordained as monks or nuns, right? And they literally leave home. Buddhist, long established Buddhist cultures, people make a decision to leave home and become an ordained, and they live in a monastery or a convent. They give up their family names. And they, like a Thich Nhat Hanh, Thich means a Shakya. So all the monks and nuns in Vietnam are part of the Shakya family, right? That technically their last name is Shakya. See? So they leave their families. And in fact, in Japan, they're very loose about this. There's a vacation and people can go home and stay at the house with their... But in India and China, it was probably very strict. You never went home. You never went home. There's a story that everybody hates, but it's about a woman who had a baby, and she wanted the baby to be a Zen monk, and he became a monk. In fact, he became the head of this temple. She gave up her son, and he became this very prominent person. And this is a story that you can just take with a giant grain of salt. But You know, basically his mother was sick and dying. And somebody came to him and said, your mother's sick and dying. Aren't you gonna go see her? And the teacher said, no. And he said, you know, did she ask for me? She said, no. Oh, she knows I've left home. And, that's just, you know, from our standpoint, that's just like, oh my, you monster, right? But the idea is you can't get free if you don't leave home. You know, it really helped my wife to leave her family, like, and put 1,000 miles between her and her dysfunctional family. You know, seeing how other people do things is so liberating. You know, you look at other families and you realize, oh, everybody doesn't argue like this all the time. You know, everybody doesn't, you know, isn't cheating on each other all the time. You know, you get out of that rut that seemed totally real and normal. I mean, I had a similar experience. Am I getting away from my family? I'm not against families, but getting away from my family was so liberating because I realized, oh, people don't have to be this unhappy all the time. You know, so being home leaver was liberating for people because not just were they no longer, you know, you've had time to meditate, you had peace and quiet, somebody made sure you had something to eat and 2 robes a year, you know. But you had a chance to rebuild your life. And, you know, we aren't monks and nuns, we're not living in a monastery, but this is like little monastery, right? So everybody's coming here, or even if you're practicing at home, you've carved out some time to like be a monastic, right? To be a, you know, basically. You've carved out some time to step out of your life and experiment with your life, you know, experiment in new ways of being. And day one is when that happens, right? And if all goes according to plan, you know, on day two, these things that might have seemed so pressing and hurtful or important begin to seem less important, you know? You know, the one of the cliches of, I think every rabbi, pastor, and priest in the United States has told in a synagogue or church the story that, you know, the famous saying that at the end of a person's life, he never wishes he had spent more time at the office. And that's like this massive cliche, but it's true, right? You know, people realize, you know, I got so stuck in my routines. You know, why did I not get out of my routines, you know? Well, I had the time. That's karma, right? That's what karma is. You know, I had umpteen chances to change my life. Why didn't I do it? Now it's too late, right? So you know, coming to Sesshin is so important because you're leaving home. You're becoming a home leaver for 5 days, I hope. And you're going to experience a different way of life, right? And it's like my wife leaving her dysfunctional family and putting 1,000 miles between herself and them, and suddenly, you don't have to be, you know, engaged in this anymore. You can do all kinds of things with your time and your interactions with other people. So you know, part of what has to happen is, you know, when we're in the so-called world, right, the so-called real world, we're actually in a big fantasy. It's like a big collective fantasy. With all due respect, our families have a collective fantasy aspect. Our workplaces have a collective fantasy aspect. You know, it's pretty clear that our political system has a collective fantasy aspect. And, you know, every once in a while we are alerted to the unreality of things. So, you know, like global warming, global climate change is is like a direct challenge to our way of life. It's saying, it seems so real, but it's not real. It seems so real that, you know, everything you were doing seems so real, but, you know, it's actually a fantasy, and it's, you know, having all these destructive consequences. So hard for people to snap out of it, because, you know, they go home to their homes, you know. They have the same routines, right? So it's hard to change if nothing in your everyday life is changing. You need an exterior perspective, right? So you know, basically, when we come to Sesshin, change becomes possible. We're stepping out of our familiar routines, and we're going to be homeless people for a little while. And being homeless is an opportunity to rebuild our experience of the world. And you know, and when we are successful, you know, on day two, all of those things that seem so important now are going to seem less important, including the things that injured us, or including the things that were terrifying to us, right? All of those could seem less important if we just change. You know, the amazing thing about humans is that they can change. See, I think that's astounding, right? We can change. We're not locked in. We're more locked in. We're less locked in than we think, because we surround ourselves with these energy habits, these routines, and some of them are good. Like, I try to go jogging every other day. I try to do about 5 or 6 miles. You know, that's good. Those are good habits. But collectively, our habits can become a trap, right? So what we need to do is sort of like de-realize our reality. We have to kind of like dissociate a little bit from our reality, and in that state of dissociation, we can begin to explore the world in a new way, right? And the mu koan, the emptiness koan, is really essential to this process of derealization, right? Of letting us see the unreality of the life we called reality. And if we can do that, we can tap into deeper parts of ourselves, right? Deeper parts of ourselves that we have not been able to engage with because, you know, we have all these inner conflicts and so on. You know, I never cease, it just never ceases to amaze me that you know, Van Gogh, the painter, never sold a single painting in his life. That's just astounding, right? He painted all of these amazing paintings and he couldn't sell a single one. You know, and I always think of him struggling with it. You know, people will say he was mentally ill, but I think one of the things that worsened his mental illness was that nobody understood what he was doing as a painter. You know, and they had all of these, he found his notebooks, and they were filled with extraordinary knowledge. He knew all of these paintings, and he was a very careful observer, and in his notebooks, he talks about different aspects of different paintings from different periods. So he wasn't like a naive painter at all, very sophisticated. And, you know, it drove him crazy that that he wasn't understood. I think he kept painting because painting lifted him out of himself, right? Painting was like his sesshin. You know, and I think it was his way. I don't think it was that as effective as Sesshin, but it gave him a way of getting out of his mental habits, which were increasingly destructive, right? And finding this place where he could reinvent his life, and he did it in his painting anyway, right? So today we need to go from thinking the world is real to realizing that it's not real, right? And we need to begin to undo our mental habits so that we can experience in new ways, right? And that means we have to leave home. We've all left home, whether we're at home on our computers, you know, we have to close the door and forget about everything that we're not supposed to forget about, right? Dizhang asked Zhuishan, "Where do you come from?" Zhuishan said, "From the south." Dizhang said, "How is Buddhism in the south these days?" Zhuishan said, "There's extensive discussion. So how can you compare that to me here planting the fields and making rice to eat?" Zhuishan said, "Well, what can you do about the world? How are you helping the world?" He said, "Well, how are you, how is what you're doing here sitting on your ass all day helping the world?" Dizhang said, "What do you call the world? What do you mean by the world? What is that? It doesn't exist, or that world doesn't exist. Source and explanation variously are all made up. Passing to ear from mouth, it comes apart. Planting fields, making rice, ordinary household matters. Only those who have investigated to the full would know. Having investigated to the full, you clearly know there's nothing to seek. Zhifeng, after all, didn't care to be enfeoffed as a marquis. Forgetting his state, he returned, same as fish and birds, washing his feet in the Konglong, the hazy waters of autumn." In other words, there's this guy named Zhifeng who was offered to become an aristocrat, and he said, "Forget it." And he walked away from all the opportunities for advancement, and he lived a simple life, the same as fish and birds, washing his feet in the Konglong, right? Just, he washed his feet in the river, right? Like an animal. So look, we have to be simple. It's so hard to be simple. But that's what we've come here to do, and to do that, we have to leave home, have to leave home. And the most powerful way to leave home is to practice Mu Xin, emptiness meditation. So let's leave home.